Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbo's most popular work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And before we get into the show for today, got a fun show, got some really fun chapters. Actually, maybe this episode represents the most fun and least fun chapters in the entire story. We'll see how we go. Anyway, before we get into that, just a few quick housekeeping notes up the top. Note number one, the Doof Discord is public. I know we announced this a few times, but we keep getting people coming into the Discord being like, oh, I didn't know this was public. So it's public. You don't have to be a patron or anything. Anyone can just join. The link to do that is to go to doofmedia.com/discord. You can just join it and talk about Wildbo stuff, talk about video games and TV shows and your five favorite action movie action scenes.
Yeah, there's a lot of Power Reflections talk that goes on in there that doesn't make it to the episode because we might talk it to death in there.
Yeah.
So that's an incentive to join. It also make it easier for you to join the game club, which I definitely recommend. So yeah, check it out.
Or just other things like, Doof and Chill streams. We'll announce them every so often in there as a way to find out when they're happening, what they're about. Anyway, so that's fun.
Well, our next one is with Malia and Jenny, which I'm very excited for.
Yes, speaking of things we're doing with Malia and Jenny, good tee up on that segue there, Elliot.
Thank you.
The other thing to take note of, to kind of announce, I suppose, is that we've got another fan art contest coming up. It's called the Pale Conflections, is that right?
I don't know how you meant to pronounce it. That sounds right. Yeah, Pale Conflections. That's our like team up name.
Yeah,
the Pale in Comparison and Pale Reflections.
Mm-hmm. A fan art contest. The theme is siblings. I think we'll have some more info on this at the end of the show. But you know, you got about a month to do some siblings related fan art. So get into it.
Yeah, there'll be a link in the show notes as well to like the full page with all the, you know, the boring rules and shit, because we actually give those to you on, like, certain people we're going to talk about today.
great segue into False Moves 12.1. This contest with our faux Marisica really starts to ramp up, and how would a fey contest start if not arguing over the semantics of the rules of the contest?
Yeah, and, like, it's just frustrating right from the get-go because despite all their efforts, the trio, or well, I suppose quintet, really, because Liberty and Snowdrop have been dragged into this as well, they've basically just walked into a situation where now they have to argue semantics and do rules lawyering against a fairy, which is just worst-case scenario.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
And like, we knew this was coming from the end of last arc, but this chapter really opens up and starts hitting you with, like, yeah, they're fucked.
Yeah, the feeling of this chapter is they've already lost the contest, really, and they're just arguing about how bad the backlash against them is going to be.
Yeah, it's almost like picking the flavor of their loss. Like, yeah.
It's glum, isn't it?
There's a real sort of frustrating negative vibe to this chapter, but like, just as a like an aside, I just loved this right from the get-go conceptually, because I don't know if we touched on this last week, but this was a, you know, murder mystery, but I think we always sort of knew when justice became a theme early on that it wasn't just going to end with like the reveal of who done it.
Yeah.
And what I love is like you then sort of think, oh well, there's going to be the trial against the culprits perhaps. But this is Wildbo, so he couldn't sort of have it be that easy, so we're also going to sneak in a sort of trial against the, like, you know, main characters, the detectives, which is just such like a fun idea, and also such a great way in a story that's talking about like the imbalances and unfairness of the system, like having the detectives end up in a kangaroo court that kind of highlights all the worst ways this shit can happen is just so perfect.
It really is great. You're right, I love the thematic relevance of it being a trial and having these kind of series of trials, I suppose, where we get to see, okay, argue for the justice you want applied to these conspirators. I mean, this one isn't that, obviously, but I'm assuming we'll get more of that. I think it's great to be like, hey, the justice system is flawed, so let's arrest these characters and then see what our version of the justice system, a better version, should be. I think it's just a great kind of thing to be doing. that doesn't apply to this trial.
No, like, I think that's what's so great about this trial is it's such a great extension of what we saw in Marisica's interlude. Like, there was the stuff with the dancing and all the stuff with the consort where it was like all this bullshit. There were all these rules and they weren't taught them. They just had to like learn it or die. Mm. And that's essentially where the Canneteers end up in this trial. It's just they're not, you know, already hundreds of year old fairy who can handle that shit. Like, this is Finia is just constantly pulling unfair bullshit because she knows the rules and they don't. It's this frustrating loop we're in where it's like she'll make some challenge that you didn't know she could do and she gets it. And then when they sort of try to counter it with something similar, theirs is invalid because of some petty technicality that we didn't really understand was a problem before anyway. It's just, it drives you nuts that there are all these rules and they don't know them.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating, isn't it? I mean, like, I think frustrating is the key emotional beat of this chapter. It's just so annoying. And I've kind of, I don't know, I think I get a bit frustrated and that frustration finds its way to be vented at the trio. And I don't think that's fair because, like, yes, they're not doing as perfectly as they could, but it's probably unrealistic. It's just so frustrating. And I'm very glad that we get the next chapter, both the cherry pop stuff and the, you know, the end of it where it's the trio kind of turning it around a bit, because after this chapter, you just need something to cleanse the palate a bit, don't you?
Yeah, I really need it. I was lucky. I got to read these chapters back to back this morning. And it was just like after 12.1, I was so glad to open 12.8, find out it was a cherry pop interlude and just be like, oh, this one's going to be a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think Wabo knew that after doing us so dirty in this chapter, he needed to give the people what they wanted.
But yeah, no, I just, like, again, I just love that you stick your detectives in an unfair trial like this, just because it's so perfect. I mean, I guess, I don't know, I'm thinking back to, like, you know, obviously stuff like this happens in real life. Like, for some reason, Orange is the New Black, I guess because I rewatched some of it recently, is jumping into my head as just, like, people were constantly having shit, like, thrown at them in that they didn't understand because they wouldn't have grown up in an environment to know this stuff, but those rules still apply to them. It's something the Canneteers have maybe lost a little bit of sight of in some respects that we'll get into soon with some of the others. So it's so great to see that kind of flipped on them, just as a reminder as they get into the end game, that, like, if you don't really know some things, this stuff can just feel like unfair bullshit, even if it seems fair to you.
I don't know. We're in the Canneteers' head, so I'm not capable of seeing anything other than the bullshit that this is.
Well, so there's one part. You've pulled out the quote here, where the Canneteers can't contest the assertion that they were here to throw Marisica / Finne off balance.
Yeah.
And I have to, I think this is one of those things where the fairy actually has a bit of an argument, because I feel like we briefly raised it as a concern way back when they first started talking about this with Rook in like 11.6. But the idea of like bullying Marisica into being on their playing field by like throwing goblins at her felt like a kind of shitty move. Like, the idea of, oh, she's a fairy, so she hates goblins, so if we like surround her with goblins and make her super uncomfortable and kind of challenge her being, that'll put her off balance and then it'll be more even. And like, I get it, because that's what you have to do with a fairy, but it still feels shitty.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing though, is it shitty? Yes. What, like, the main thing to think about from this is, like, you can't engage the Fae on their level. You can't play the game against the Fae, right? And I know you kind of thought about this as well. As an example, they bring in the Aurum, who's kind of like the Faeist of the judges, right? Rules over.
Yeah.
I mean, the quote from 11.3 is, "The Aurum Coil manages new rules of discourse, such as music, drama, or technological." And I'm like, new rules of discourse, like drama, like the Aurum is so here for all the dumb shit that the Fae are pulling. And it's just not how you can play. Like, you just can't do that. And so,
yeah, I had the same thought. Like, bringing in the Aurum was absolutely a mistake. Because, like,
yeah,
I think we've talked before, like my primary read on the Fae is that they sort of represent all of the bullshit we make up about ourselves. And at the end of the day, that's kind of what society is.
Oh, it's like, 100%.
Yeah. Like, you know, that's still a good thing, but like society is made up bullshit and that's kind of what the Fae are. And so just like seeing this go down, I was like, oh, bringing the Aurum for the fairy thing was definitely a mistake. It's like bringing like a barrel of gasoline to a firefight. Like you don't bring the representation of society into a fight against the epitome of society.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly, right? And so you say like, yeah, it's a fair point, and I'm kind of like, I guess it is, but you can't, even acknowledging that it's a fair point is playing the game to an extent, and that's just how, you just can't do that. Like there's another one here where Verona's like, she thinks to herself, she has to play the game back and starts doing like counterpoints and being like, oh, maybe I can request a sidebar, blah, blah, blah. And like, sure, they score some small points over the course of this chapter, but the fact that this chapter goes the way it does is kind of an indictment of that strategy, right? Like,
yeah,
it just doesn't work.
Well, and this is the frustrating thing about fighting the fairy, and why, like, at the end of the day, I kind of concede that the goblin plan was probably a good one. It's because you can't fight them with fairness and civility, and like when that is gone, I don't know what to do. Like it drives me nuts. It reminds me about some of the stuff we talked about with Alexander and Bristow, where like the Caneteers just kind of had to be shitty in some ways because the system and the odds were so stacked in Alexander and Bristow's favor.
Mm.
And it feels a little bit like that with some of this stuff because I don't know, how do you combat the fairy in a fair way when fighting them in a fair way plays into their hands and they're going to abuse it? Like I don't feel like I have an answer for this. Like, what do you do in a way, like, you know, especially from like Lucy's perspective, she's really focused at the moment on wanting to be able to do these things and hold her head up high afterwards about how she did it. And I don't know how you can do that against the fairy anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I actually don't know if it's possible. I mean, like the only thing I can think is to win the engagement and then offer the fairy an olive branch is the only way to be able to do it, but even that, it feels wrong.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like I'm just doing circles in my head. Like I can't, every time I think of something it's like, well, that's not really, yeah, good. Like that's a problem. Like the fairy kind of represent every well, you know, when they're being malicious, the fairy represent everything that's kind of wrong with society, and then I don't want to take civility away, but you also can't use it. I hate this.
Yeah But so yeah, Finia, the fake Fae, has a sidebar with the Aurum, which seems to go very well, suspiciously well, and a lot of the terms of this contest end up being determined in secret.
Yeah. I do want to give Finia credit for this one moment where Lucy says, bullcrap, you know what you're doing, and you know what you've done here. And Finia responds, if that is a condemnation of me, if that is a condemnation of me knowing what I'm doing, then it would explain what you've done here. And I got to give her credit for that. That's a good burn. like, because I guess we'll get into this. We probably won't, but like later, Miss sort of phrases Finia as a fairy that's at Marisica's level, but with very different strengths.
Mm.
And that just added like another angle of why I love the concept of this trial so much, because the Caneteers came into this as in their goat lizard wolf form as a kind of switcheroo. So it's like, oh, she'll be fighting against, you know, the parts of us that she's not expecting to. And Marisica's just subbed herself out in like a very similar-ish way.
Mm.
It's just such a beautiful maneuver to like, in a way, bamboozle them with their own strategy again.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's good, isn't it? So should we talk about this bullshit sidebar? Like, again, it's like, what? Like, I already have rock bottom trust of the Aurum, and this doesn't help. Lucy asks, would we be happy with this? And that question is completely dodged. So the question that this bears is the Aurum being an unfair judge here? What does that even mean?
I mean, to obviously, next chapter, the parallels between this and the Edith trial become more explicit, but like this reeks of the same suspicious bullshit that went on. Do you remember that moment where the Sable just
100%
like...
100% I do. Is that something that's going to happen in every single trial? Like...
Like, it's just, this is like a very different flavor, but it's the same bullshit where, like, one of these judges disappears with a culprit for a bit and comes back, and suddenly, like, all this shit's happening, and it's like, are we going to talk about, like, how bullshit this is? I don't know. This sidebar, like, is much worse than anything that ever happened in The Good Wife, because as you said, it just comes out, and there's so much, like, oh, yes, remember the thing from the sidebar? I'll concede 0.3 from that. Or it's like, yeah, okay. And it's like, this is so fucking unfair.
Yeah. It's bullshit. It's clearly bullshit.
I'm just, like, holding on to some, like, small, unrealistic tinfoil that maybe Finn is actually setting herself up to lose or wants the Kenneteers to win or, like, I don't like... If Marissica is expecting her to win, then if she loses, that hurts Marissica, and maybe that's what she brought up in the side, but I don't know. I'm absolutely grasping at straws.
Yeah, I don't know. It's rough.
I mean, like, we get to the thing where later on we learn that that's, like, quite explicitly a reflection of not just how they were going to tackle Marissica, but also what they did to Edith. And maybe that's it. Maybe... What's being tested here is their commitment to their own, like, values of justice. Like, maybe they just win this by sticking to their guns. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think. Do you remember? There's, like, this quote that really sticks with me. It's from, like, the final episode of Firefly, where this guy talks about how, like, psychologists have to get psychologically tested before they're allowed to practice, and the guy in the episode talking about how, like, surgeons should have to get surgery performed on themselves before they're allowed to be surgeons. It's a stupid comparison in the episode, but
interesting. If this is a
test of the Kenneteers' sense of justice.
Who is setting this test up? I can see how it's a test thematically and narratively, but, you know, is Finia bought into that? Is the Aurum bought into that? That doesn't feel right to me.
I mean, Finia says she's not Marissica's ally. Like, if there's a way that she can sabotage, this is also me kind of grasping at straws. I could see a way that this unravels where, like, the reveal is that actually, you know, that what they were being tested on here was their commitment to what they've done. Like, basically having shit thrown at them and them standing by their sense of justice.
The Finia saying that she's not Marissica's ally rings like bullshit to me. I mean, like, the counterpoint to that is you are acting like her ally right now. What's the difference between someone acting like an ally and an ally? There's no fucking difference.
It's very shit. She'll stab her in the back the second it's worth it. I don't know. Or, you know, and again, like, the other side of this is we get two reminders next chapter. Marissica is still obligated to help the Kenneteers live long and full lives. And I just have to believe that leaving them with Finia like this, like, has to be against that. Like, leaving them here in a trial against a malicious fairy, like, if there's a genuine chance that she's going to, like, let them get sold to the fairy courts or whatever the fuck, like, that just has to be in breach of Marissica's contract.
Yeah, in a sick way, the worse that this could go, the better they can use it against Marissica later.
Yeah, and maybe that's Finia's thing. Maybe that's the whole, like, Finia wants, like, the more Finia wins, the more it hurts Marissica, and that's actually, like, her argument in the sidebar. So I don't know, but, like, that's the interesting thing about Marissica next chapter is we see her and we get these reminders that actually either, like, she believes it or she's got some plan that means that it's technically true. Like, she wants the Kenneteers to have long and full lives, and she makes that abundantly clear next chapter, and that's such an interesting wrinkle in how the rest of this arc is going to unfold. She is reminding the universe that that is a thing she has to do. So unless there's a bullshit interpretation of that we haven't thought of, yeah, there's always so bad things can get for them while she's the primary antagonist.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know. I still have no idea how this could play out, right?
No. Me either. I'm just, like, throwing spaghetti at the wall.
I just want to pull out one more thing from this, which is the Kenneteers don't score a lot of points during this, but they do score some points. And one of the times where they force Finia to backpedal and adjust is when Phineas says something like, fuck, what is it? It's like a really clunky food metaphor, right?
Yeah, I think it's when they ask for, like, the ability to take a recess, and she goes on about how that's unfair because they were here to surprise her or whatever, and then she gives,
it's like they're asking for whipped cream on top of, it's nonsense.
Oh, it's like, whipped cream beside the meal or something, which, what are you talking about?
Yeah, clearly she has no idea what humans eat. Anyway, and Lucy's response is, what, fuck you, fuck off with that, and Liberty adds, that's freaking ridiculous. And that's it. That's all that they say. And that's enough to get Finia to backtrack and to score a point, a small point, but a point.
Mm.
And it's kind of another moment to just hammer home the idea of, like, if you're actually playing the game and arguing with Finia, you're losing. The only way to win is just to not allow her to just basically call off how ridiculous the shit she's doing is. And I'm jumping ahead in our notes here a bit, Elliot, but The overall feeling that this leaves me is so strongly this feeling of, and this is especially relevant when we're recording this episode, of like an alt-right person who's begging people to debate them. You know the kind of stereotype I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
But then, like, if you ever stoop to that level and engage with them as though what they're saying has any basis in fact, you're already kind of normalizing their behavior, and like
you've legitimized them by entering an official debate with them.
Exactly. Yeah. And even if you do debate them and win in that debate, if they're defining the rules of this engagement, they'll just make shit up or I'm explicitly referencing this Steven Crowder situation. I don't know if you're aware of this, Elliot.
I'm not.
It's fucking hilarious. Steven Crowder, big alt-right YouTuber. Kind of vibes, begs Ethan from H3, to debate him. I mean, Ethan's not a political pundit, he's just kind of another YouTuber. And Ethan agrees and then surprises him by bringing on an actual political commentator, right, to debate against him. And Steven Crowder kind of throws a hissy fit and runs away. But then, key to that, later releases a video where he's edited this engagement to point out, like, any of these tiny moments that he's won and use it to be like, I actually won this debate and blah, 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 and kind of,
classic.
Spun it, right? And I mean, it is. It's the classic thing of, like, even if you're playing that game, you're losing. And that's what it's like with the Fae, right? There's no way you can engage with them on their level and walk away victorious. Even if you feel like you're walking away victorious, they still have the ability to spin it. And the key fact that will be true that you can't deny is, you normalized their way of doing things,
You're right. Like, that's so much of what's going on here. I know we've already talked about this, so I'll do it so quickly, but like, that's what's so frustrating here is the reason the Kenneteers are losing so much right here is because they're trying to be fair and talk this out.
Yeah. And that's bullshit. You can't do that. Lost.
Exactly. Like, the fact that they're trying to talk it out is what's costing them, and I just fucking hate that. I love that call out you just have of like the time where they actually managed to score a few points is when their response is just fuck you, fuck off with that.
Fuck you, like, that's shit. Like, that's not anything. We won't even, debase ourselves by responding to it. Yeah. And that's the closest they come to doing anything.
I hadn't noticed that, and I love it. Like, that's such a great call out.
The trio start to try and take a bit of control, and they start pursuing Finia on her connection to Mariska, which is what this whole trial is actually about. But Finia and Mariska were clearly cautious about this, and there are no real points to be made there. it's a telling moment, right? They almost pin her on something, but it's clear that, the gray line here is where Finia and Mariska live and breathe, and it doesn't work. In fact, it gets spun to be points against them.
Yeah. But something we haven't talked about up until now is so in this particular moment with the Mariska stuff, Verona kind of takes the front spot on the arguing, and she cops it for kind of losing this, and she instantly gets like quite sick.
Yeah. And I mean, it gives the vibes that not only has her practice taken a hit, but the kind of downsides of the alchemy that she's done is amplified.
Yeah, exactly. This feels like our taste test of what's to come if they really lose this challenge. Like this is a minor gainsaying sort of vibe, is the impression I get. And if they lose properly, well, apparently there's a chance they'll get sold to the courts. So,
yep.
Who the fuck knows? But, I guess this is a Verona chapter, and we've barely talked about her so far. And part of that is because, she's taken this six berry mixture, and now is just kind of like, it's really thrown her for a loop. And in this moment, it's like her headache and stuff starts to get worse. And that's like, you know, like Verona having a headache in the back of her head that's buzzing is just, that's our signal that she's in a really bad spot. And I feel bad that part of me was kind of like, see, Verona, you turned other and look how it's gone. she's so long romanticized turning other. And I always think that that's not been a fair assessment of what being other is. And it's kind of great that I feel like she's starting to realize that. As this turns, like, and even before it, honestly, like she can't really think straight earlier on. In 11.13, she was kind of uncomfortable as it was happening. I think this experiment maybe should have happened earlier, because it is sort of reinforcing the idea that being other isn't super cool, happy, fun times.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that there's something good to come out of this, I guess.
Yeah, if she survives long enough for this lesson to land, it'll be great. I mean, she actually, I do want to give her credit, though. Earlier in the chapter, she tries to get turned into a fairy as part of all this, which I very much enjoyed.
Mm.
But she gets a little bit sad that she didn't get her free chance to try out being Fae. Classic Verona.
Good stuff, Verona. The contest is set. They're in the forest with Fae all around, and these Fae are fitting the Kenneteers for clothes.
And this really escalates, just the amount of bullshit going on. Like, the demerits start flying left, right, and center immediately.
Mm,
and there's just clearly no winning. Like, Avery and Lucy get demerited for, like, talking back. So then Verona stands there quietly and they're like, that's rude. You know, also 50 demerits. It's just like, fuck this. Like, there's no winning. They'll just throw demerits out for whatever the fuck they feel like. There's no discernible system to this.
Yeah,
it's a level up and a crystallization of the bullshit we were talking about before in like court systems that you're not familiar with, where you just get punished for not knowing the rules that you weren't taught.
Yeah, it's it's really rough. I really hate it, and I know I'm meant to hate it. I hope otherwise. I don't know, but like I think especially because Lucy's my favorite Kenneteer, and this is like especially designed to fuck with Lucy. I mean, it's fucking with and kind of weakening the identity of all of the Kenneteers, but God, it's so... I hate it so much.
Did they actually touch her hair? Like, I it didn't come up, so I don't think they did, but they went to again, which is just, you know, aggravating.
Yeah.
But because we're in this sort of, you know... I think Verona says she took the spirit of Long into her. So because we're kind of seeing everything through this warped, like, Long Verona perspective, she doesn't follow up on the thought of whether Lucy's hair was actually touched. So I hope it wasn't, but there's a chance it was.
Yeah.
Just back on how unfair all the demerit shit is. They take demerit points off Snowdrop for disagreeing about whether they were going to do the trial. And then when they try to explain that Snowdrop has a special rule of discourse, they get more demerits. And it's just like the epitome of fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the part that really got to me. I was like, fuck off. You can't, you know.
Yeah.
But as the flip side of that, we get a very touching moment where Avery finds out that Liberty put this whole costume together for her, kind of specially.
Yeah.
It's just, you know. Like, Avery's, like, love language is just so clearly, like, is it service? Is that the one where you just do things
for people? Yeah, acts of service.
Yeah. And, like you could tell that this is just, like, in amongst all this bullshit, there's just a moment where Avery's like, aw.
Yeah, it's nice to have those little moments to keep us going, huh?
Yeah.
But, yeah, the court continues to award demerits to the trio for not playing along with this bullshit. For Lucy and Verona get a message that Lucy's house has been infiltrated. and Lucy continues to slip as the trial carries on. I don't have anything else to say about this. It's just so it's designed to get under your skin, probably literally, and it does.
Yeah, I almost shit myself when we found out what the text said. I was like, oh fuck, of course that's what Marisica's up to. Like, I mean, this is such a great moment from a story perspective, because we've had so much build up with all those wards, and it's like right when we already thought we were on the bottom, Wildbo hits us with like something that we've kind of been waiting to see, which is somebody going after their families.
Yeah. It's happening, and we'll see it next chapter.
Before we go, I just wanted to end the talk of this chapter on a hypothetical, which is so they there's one point where the fairy is saying they're going to sell 1 3/4 of a person. And the way the 3/4 of a person works is that she will be given the option of serving out 3/4 of her remaining lifetime and then retain the ability to buy back her freedom at 1/3 the auction price she raises, or forfeiting 3/4 of her humanity to be rendered, butchered, and sold before the remainder of herself is rendered free once again to find her way in the greater realms of other and man. Which would you choose?
Probably number one, I suppose. Or like, maybe number two. I mean, you know, the part that's chopped off.
Well, number one's kind of bullshit, because where are you meant to get the money to buy back your freedom? That's my question.
Yeah, and, you know, if they can make up demerits that have you serving 3/4, they can just make up demerits during that time to get the extra time, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it's leaving you. But then, oh, like, losing 3/4 of your humanity, that can't be good.
Yeah, the left of a quarter might not even know, you know? Might not even, I don't know.
Hey, I mean, that's true.
I guess maybe that's what happened to, like, Brett.
Oh my god, Brett went through this trial a couple of months ago. It all makes sense now.
A couple of months ago, I think longer than that ago. Earlier. Oh, anyway.
A year or so ago. The divorce is fairly recent.
Yeah, true. Anyway, let's get out of this chapter and go into False Move 12A, Cherry Pop. We're in Cherry Pop's head for this one.
What a dream come true.
And before we get into this, I just want to point out something that I missed on my first read that maybe other people missed too, which is even the fucking links and stuff on this page are spelled wrong. So to be clear, the title of this arc is False Moves, and normally the interludes are 12 point whatever, right? Yeah. Whereas this one is False Move 12A with no bullet point. It's not an interlude, it's an interrude. And instead of previous chapter and next chapter, it says previous chapter and next chapter. It's just great. Like, it's so good.
I only noticed the chapter misspellings. I missed the rest of it. So thanks for pointing out, like, interrude. I totally missed that. But, like, I noticed the chapter ones as soon as I started reading this, and I was like, because, you know, I'm reading this like 4 days after it came out. So part of me was like, oh boy, that's a bit embarrassing for Wildbo. These are both grossly misspelled after, because like the first word of the chapter is just cherry pop.
Cherry pop.
And I was like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
and then obviously, like, just, oh, a cherry pop interlude. I couldn't have asked for anything better. Like, this is the perspective we needed to see.
I mean, it's the interlude we've all been waiting for, right? It starts out with Cherry Pop being scared, but, you know, she has the stones to try and get to Jasmine's house anyway.
she's so precious, right? Like, we all know Cherry is like this insecure, annoying piece of shit a lot of the time, but when you see in her head, it's just exactly what you expect from, well, a child who's like that. Like, she's lonely and wants recognition, and it just comes out as her being an annoying asshole. But from her perspective, like, she's just trying so goddamn hard, and she's actually so kind of pure and innocent, and I just fucking love it.
She's great. Actually, before we get into it, let's give props to Ace of Sword, who was the one who made the prediction we talked about last chapter, where talking about Cherry Pop's stubbornness and stupidness kind of interacting perfectly with the cursed stone, and talking about how Cherry Pop's going to get buff, which is in the process of happening now. So I just think Ace deserves props. It's such a good, hilarious premise for this chapter, for the first part of this chapter, at least. Because, like, I mean, this entire chapter is dripping with dramatic irony, with this vibe of, like, J-pop just not getting stuff that we as the audience know. And it's so hilarious and juicy every single time. Like, every time J-pop is struggling through the first part of this chapter, she'll make sure to readjust the stone under her arm to make sure it's perfectly secure before she tries again. And it's just so good.
Yeah, I agree. I think this chapter balances that marvelously. I've got a bunch of quotes spread throughout this script that I'm going to pull out just because they make me laugh every time I read them. Mm. Yeah, like as you say, like she grabs the rock every fucking damn time. And she's like, oh, I barely made that, but at least I've got my rock with me. And it's just like, oh, you fucking dumbass.
Yeah, it's rough. But having said that, it's also like a good mix of like tragic and inspiring, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
well, Cherry, I mean, that's Cherry Pop.
Yeah, like she's so beaten down by life, but is so determined to just keep trying. And it's very wonderful, especially with all the stuff that she thinks about Snowdrop, which is also hilarious and, you know, wholesome.
Yeah, like you know, something that the chapter makes fairly explicit towards the end is this whole thing where, like, she barely notices that everything is suddenly a lot harder. Like, and that the rock is making everything worse. And it's just because, like, that's just how life is for Cherry all the time. Everything is hard for her all the time.
Mm.
So she just doesn't notice that the rock is making things harder because she, I guess, you know, the world she's in, comparing herself to everyone else, she's smaller, stupider. It just is always harder for her. So she just doesn't notice when she's cursed or, in this case, carrying around a rock that's cursing her and making it harder. It's tragic and inspiring. It is just exactly it. You're like, oh, this sucks, but also you can't help but fall in love with what a little trooper she is.
Yeah. As well as seeing her internal monologue still fail to understand Snowdrop's backwards talk. It's just so fucking good. It's never going to get old. She thinks about things like, oh, Snowdrop told me this one time that if she died, she'd definitely 100% come back to life. So, and I thought that was really cool. I'm like, fucking hell, Cherry.
And that's used to, like, also to help frame, like, this idolization she has of Snowdrop.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't just love Snowdrop for all the stuff we'll get into in a sec with, like, how great Snowdrop is. She literally thinks Snowdrop is immortal and can come back to life. So the idea that something scares Snowdrop is just like maximum shit your pants time. It's so good. And then, so just this way she idolizes Snowdrop, I think, really captures the vibe of this chapter, which is just like another extension of all the stuff we've talked about with goblin society being peer pressure bullshit and goblins kind of being kids. Like, Cherry Pop's just lonely and she just wants people she doesn't even want people to treat her well. She just doesn't want to get left in a dark room with broken bones for a couple of days. Like, she set her bar for what she wants out of a crew absurdly low, and Snowdrop is still effectively the first person to ever, like, meet that bar.
Yeah.
She just thinks the absolute world of Snowdrop just because Snowdrop's the only person who hasn't treated her like shit. Like, it, again, tragic and inspiring.
Hmm. Yeah, she's great. I mean, she's obviously a favorite character of ours and continues to be so. This interlude is everything we've ever wanted, I think.
Yeah, and she touches on how Toadswallow is, like, one of the other few people who's kind of given her some respect or whatever, but they, you know, her and Toadswallow are very different people, so they don't actually get on. And you can see, like, this to me just fully sells Toadswallow's plan to put Snowdrop as the Goblin Sage, because Snowdrop is just constantly pulling out the best of goblins, like Cherry Pop. Like, this just cements that as a brilliant idea. I think we knew it was anyway, but, like, this is the evidence right here. Like,
yeah.
She's going to fix Cherry Pop, and, like, that, if you can do that, you can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we get this scene of Cherry trying and failing to get over a river.
It's the most epic. Like, this is like a quarter of the chapter, and it's so fucking, like, because, you know, she keeps calling it a river. I'm willing to bet this is like a 2 meter across, like, stream, right? Like, it's like, I bet you this is one of the narrower parts of the creek that goes through Kennet.
Mm. Yeah, it's so good. I mean, the fact that it's built up to be this epic thing is what makes it so perfect, right?
Because we know it's not. And it reminds me
again of... Well, but it is to Cherry, but it's not to literally anybody else, yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me of my favorite interlude from Ward, which I guess I won't go into because this isn't like a Ward spoilers podcast, but it's an early one. People probably know what I'm thinking of. And it had some similar-ish vibes just with a competent point of view character. But like, yeah, just watching Cherry fucking turn crossing what I assume is more or less a creek into this fucking epic journey is just so good.
Yeah, it is great, isn't it?
Like this is her version of like getting to Mount Doom in Mordor. Like,
yeah, but well, she fails. She almost does it, but she fails and almost drowns before she is rescued and resuscitated by Tashlit, Rook, and Miss.
She needed Pekkasnot, who's her Samwise Gamgee.
Mm. Yeah, exactly, I guess. Although, well, they'll get there, maybe. We'll see.
But yeah, no, the rock is actually her version of the ring. It's all coming together.
Yeah, it'll tracks.
Again, just a line that makes me laugh every time I read it, which is where, like, yeah, Tashlit does some sort of CPR to bring Cherry Pop back to life. And Rook is like, Cherry Pop, that rock is cursed. And Cherry Pop just sort of grabs it and is like, it's a good rock, don't lie. It's just like, oh, she's so proud of her rock that fucking Snowdrop took and got them to curse. Like, the poor thing.
So good. I want to pull out something else that I really liked from this chapter, which is Miss saying that Mariska had her fake self suggest to the girls that you and I, talking to Rook, were allied, and their reaction or lack of reaction told her enough, she knows. Which I think is great, just because if you go back and listen to our episode, I fell for this trick as well. I was like, how did Mariska know about this? I totally would have given it away if I was in that scenario.
I mean, that's the fairy bullshit, right, isn't it? It's no matter what you do, you've given them what they need.
It's such a classic trick as well to say something assuming it's true and let the reaction confirm it. Like, it's great that all of the tricks that we would fall for from the Fae are the most basic, but just they just work, I guess. They're classics for a reason.
Yeah, and they use them very well. Like, and you know, this is to Wabo's credit as well, obviously, the way he's able to bury these tricks in all the nonsense around them. Like, it's not just about the trick, it's about the way you build up the pile of bullshit around it so that it gets lost. It's the needle in the haystack. Like, that's what's so great about this.
Yeah.
And also, this does tell us, for Miss to know that, she was there watching?
Yeah.
Because Mariska didn't notice.
No.
So that's, God, like, Miss is a really good spy. I mean, this explains how she was able to, like, even affect, she was, like, effectively spying on, like, Alexander and the other augurs because she knew so much about them.
Yeah.
Like, she's really good at spying.
She's just she's great. She's a great boon to have on the team.
Yeah.
Cherry is then sent on a mission to help at Jasmine's house by fucking with Marcy. Rook gives her three objectives before she heads inside.
Again, after fucking taking the stone to Mordor, she's like infiltrating.
We're going through all the hits here. What a fun setup for this second half is as well. Like, having Rook explain, like, okay, Cherry, you just need to do these three really basic things, and then seeing it inside of Cherry's head as it's almost like, it's like, you know, Mission Impossible or like Ocean's 11 or whatever, where they explain the plan as you're seeing it play out. Rook explains the plan and we see it play out, and Cherry just fucks it up. Or, I mean, doesn't fuck it up. She does very well, but it's just very funny to listen as she does things like immediately forget one of the three tasks.
Cherry Pop feels like the embodiment of that thing we all do, you know, where you like walk into the kitchen and then you're like, wait, why am I in here again?
Mm.
And then you walk out and you're like, oh, fuck, that's right. Like, I needed to grab my keys that I left on the bench in there. And you go back in there and then you're back in the room and you're like, what am I doing in here again? And then you see the keys on the kitchen bench and it triggers it for you. Like, that's the only reason she gets half this shit done is because she sees things like the bag and she's like, oh, fuck, yeah, the bag.
Mm.
And I mean, this is a great, I think, this is sort of Wildbo following through on something. The story's told us a bunch of times. When people give instructions to goblins, oh, the goblins will probably forget. You know, you shouldn't be trusting goblins with that many things. And, you know, this is sort of the story kind of demonstrating why exactly that is. Just, I think it's really cool to see the other side of this, where Rook gives Cherry Pop three fairly simple instructions, and then we see Cherry Pop go in there and kind of get lucky to pull them all off to a degree. I just really like the story following up on something that's established like that with, oh, don't trust goblins to do stuff.
Yeah.
And also props to Rook for like
for putting making this plan it all happen together. Yeah,
like I'm still kind of writing my Rook might have been a fairy before she was an Oni thing, just cause,
oh interesting,
because like this just like I don't know, maybe maybe that is unfair. I should probably stop trying to focus on that, because it's probably like the rudest thing you can do to an Oni, because it's exactly what they're trying to get away from. But like at the very least, she's picked up the skills to sort of feel like she's able to play some chess moves against a fairy, which is just impressive.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, the fact that Cherry managed to pull off two of them, almost three, it really speaks to how well Rook did here.
Yeah, the fact that you can get Cherry Pop and Pekkasnot to kind of pull Marisica to a draw, like yeah. that's good. Something that doesn't come up actually since we're no longer in Marisica's head, none of them have clocked onto this fact that she's trying to avoid being a fairy. Like that feels like something that will have to come into it eventually. I just wonder, like Rook's got to be the person to make that leap, right?
I mean, you'd hope so. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyhow, inside, Marcy is sowing some major trouble for Lucy and Verona. Cherry, however, teams up with Pekkasnot, and together they manage to disrupt it.
Yeah, they are the heroes we deserve.
They're good, aren't they?
I love this vibe. Like, this is the stuff that I just will never get enough of, the like magic in the real world stuff of like, you know, out of Jasmine's sight, Marisica is like shooting vines at them and they're fighting them like inside the bag. Like, just all that like out of the sight of innocence, like magic fighting shit going on under the table. It's always fun.
It is good, isn't it? The extra, you know, tension of having to avoid the line of sight of the innocents makes it delightful.
Yeah, and then when they're both out of it, yeah, like just, you know, Marisica throwing little bits of shit at them and stuff. Well, they'd throw pieces of shit at her. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But yeah, Cherry does really well. She almost gets 3 out of 3. Marisica also kind of has the rock during the moments where she's interacting with Jasmine. I mean, I don't know if it actually helped or not, but you know, Cherry does very well. Undeniably, she does very, very well here.
Yeah, I got the impression she never quite gets the rock, because she almost, basically as soon as she actually gets her shoes, she like immediately throws it in the vent or whatever. But yeah, like Cherry got one of the important things, which was fucking up the bag, and she did it using the third thing, which was to play good with Pekkasnot. Despite her, like, she finds that so hard, but she just does it. It's so good.
Maybe the hardest of all of them.
Yeah, that was the only one she found difficult. Actually putting up with this guy that she sees herself competing with. That's like, I don't think we've talked about it, but she's got the biggest grudge against Sig as well. Like, that's another one of these just comedy beats spread throughout the chapter. It's just she constantly thinking about how she needs to get revenge on that cigarette. You're such an idiot, Cherry Pop. I love you.
Yeah. Let's also give some props to Jasmine, who is so good here. Basically, as soon as the playing field isn't unfairly supernaturally leveled against her, she's able to score some major points. It's very cathartic after the horror show of 12.1.
Yeah, it's really great to see. Yeah, the moment where she finds like the shit stained toilet paper or whatever in the bag, she's just immediately like, hold on, can you clarify things for me? And Marisica is not able to keep up with, like, Jasmine just, like, you know, vibing with Lucy and just bull rushing past the bullshit. Like, every time Marisica starts to paint these wide pictures, Jasmine's like, no, 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 no. Just answer my question. It's, yeah, very cathartic.
Yeah, it's very good.
There is this moment, though, where, like, Jasmine, Marisica says something, I can't quite remember what it was, and Jasmine, like, raises her hand and looks like she's about to slap Marisica, and she sort of stops herself last minute and just asks Marisica to leave. And I was like, I've never been this upset that somebody didn't resort to violence.
Mm.
Because just, like, if she'd slapped her, that would have, like, completely broken the glamour and stuff, right? Like, that would have been a huge win. But also, Jasmine can't know that. I cannot bring myself to say that Jasmine should have slapped her. But
yeah,
like,
no, I mean, I'm sure that it would have worked out okay. I don't think Marisica would have ended up taking ownership of Jasmine's innocence. But yeah, let's not chance it.
Yeah, no, it's just one of those things where, like, Jasmine absolutely made the right call with all the information she has. But it's like, oh, if you only understood the crazy bullshit going on here, actually a light slap is the answer. But you did the right thing. Anyway, we get some interesting details out of Marisica, though, in this section where she's on the back foot, which I think are worth calling out. The first one is kind of morbid, but Marisica says that she is with an organization that has worked with Cass in the past, which presumably means that the Darkfall Court had an agreement with Cass, which that's fun.
Do you think the Darkfall Court is the group being referred to? Do you think maybe it's just like Kennet as a whole or something?
Maybe, yes.
And Verona is the one who's interacted with Cass. I don't know.
Or maybe Charles has had something to do with Cass and the organization is the conspiracy.
Yeah,
I don't know.
True.
I read it as just being about Darkfall because I'm pretty sure they're the ones who are so affiliated with kidnapping kids.
Okay, yeah. That's pretty grim, isn't it?
So. Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of Dark Spring, but I thought it was Darkfall. But like the other sort of takeaway from this section is like, so Marisica leaves and she kind of gets scared off. She takes flight. She gets away. And Rook sort of is like, oh man, we're lucky she's still really bad at this. And wait, just to come for that to come sort of at the end of these two chapters we've been talking about today, this is the Marisica who's still an amateur, who's shit at this. Like, that's terrifying. Like, thank goodness Guillaume's kind of freezing out the other way, or he must have been terrifying in his prime.
Yeah, I hope we don't get to see how terrifying Guillaume would be in situations like these.
Yeah, well, like all this bullshit going on is being framed around the idea that Marisica's not even that good for a fairy. Like,
yeah,
what a way to talk fairy up.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah,
I mean, hopefully they're all grossly underestimating her, right? That's the takeaway.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that. So yeah.
So what do you think Marisica was going for by coming to Jazz's place, and do you think they stopped it?
I mean, obviously we can't say for sure because fairy operate on levels that are incomprehensible by us mere mortals. Yeah. But I think I would guess that it's getting Jasmine to be more of an obstruction to Lucy and Verona going out and doing stuff for Kennet, right?
Like, yeah,
taking them off the board as much as possible.
Yeah, that was my read as well. Like, which I guess, like, I'm confused about whether Cherry Pop and Pekkasnot achieved anything with what they did in the house by getting Marisica to leave. Because, like, Toadsawyer sort of says at one point, I think the damage is already done. And that would be my read. Like, Jasmine's new read on this situation is that there's some creepy poop carrying, like, weirdo going through town right now. That's not going to make her more likely to give the Kenneteers freedoms, right? Like, the fact is, it seems Connor and Jasmine were already aware the Kenneteers were missing, were already a bit worried and upset before Marisica even came around. So it's like, to some degree, her showing up has still achieved what it wanted to. And I guess the characters kind of say that, but then I'm like, I guess what did Team Rook get anything out of this? Is it just, I suppose Jasmine's calling other mums now, so maybe people are going to be looking out for Marisica?
Yeah.
That feels thin.
And I think the stage has been set for Verona and Lucy to be able to get out of any potential problems with Jazz, right? Like, this feels like they are now more able to explain it away somehow, you know?
No. Like, I can't, because Jazz now thinks there's a creepy lady who carries poop in her bag after them. Who knows things that she shouldn't know? Like, that's gonna.
But Jasmine thinks this is, you know, a local racist, right? Not if it was. Hey, we. There's something here where you need to take better care of your children or whatever, or, you know, Verona's in danger or something. Jasmine would be very, very, unwilling to listen to the trio in how they think it should be handled. Whereas now it's, they're at least have a seat at the table to discuss, you know what I mean? They're not the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, and they might have the ability to say, oh, we know who that is.
Yeah, like, totally.
Yeah.
And actually, we want to go and do something that will help get her locked away or whatever,
Hey, let's get a bunch of innocents and we're going to go visit the fairy cave and just, like, really, like, fuck up
Marisica's
day.
Yeah, she's this homeless woman who lives in a cave. Do you want to come check it out? Anyway, yeah, so with the rock in tow, Cherry heads back to the forest, and almost all of Kennet is here to keep an eye on the trio. The Kenneteers, emboldened by knowing that they have allies all around them, start to finally score some points.
It's so nice to see just the entirety of Kennet here and, like, kind of caring. Like, my heart warmed when Cherry sort of arrives and notes that, yeah, everyone's here.
Yeah, it is very nice, isn't it? Well,
except for Charles.
Not everyone. I don't think we get Guillemet there either, do we?
Ooh, no, good point.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, there were some pale predictions that I don't think we pulled out that talked about that, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of people seem to think Guillemet is going to be involved in how this trial ends.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's the other fae in town, so it makes sense.
Yeah, true. If anybody can play on their level. I also just love here, you mentioned how the Kenneteers start to get emboldened. It's not just the kid, it's mostly Avery. And I love seeing it be Avery who comes in at the last minute to, like, think their way out of it, because that's something she's constantly beating herself up for being bad at.
Mm.
And that this moment of her being like, will you guys back me? Lucy saying yes, and then, like, her and Snowdrop holding both of her hands. Like, it's just such a peak Avery moment. I just felt so good for her.
I think I think it's great that it's Avery as well, but also, you know, Verona's totally fucked in this circumstance, and Lucy, the face stuff seems like designed to throw Lucy off her game, so it had to kind of be Avery, and I'm very glad that she rose to the challenge.
Well, she it feels good because she. Well, for one, like, for I guess part one of why it feels great that it's her is because she's meant to be the wolf right now and the one who lies in wait, and she just kind of does seem to stand in the back of most of this conversation until she suddenly strikes with her 3-point plan about why this is all bullshit.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't know. It's just also just, like, I agree, it kind of had to be her, but like, in the past, this is something she has kind of failed to step up and do.
Mm.
So it's a big sort of moment of growth for her that she was able to do this.
Yeah, yeah. It is a good moment.
Like, I could see other parts of the story where, like, you know, the Verona vomiting in the back is still the one who manages to pull this off. yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about this, the Cherry having the rock, right? Because... Yeah. She beat the rock on the river, she beat the rock on the river and then kind of lost it or gave it to Marcy before regaining it. Does she have to beat it another time now? I mean, it seems like it's starting to power up again. If she bounces it back to Mariska again after this, I feel like that'll be especially good. And I really do hope that happens.
I'm a little unclear. I do think she has to beat it again because there was the whole thing of, like, the reason she was able to hand it off was because she had climbed her own mountain. I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing from 1113.
Yeah.
But my understanding is, yeah, essentially if you beat the stone, then you can hand it off to someone and it gets worse. And so I think what's happened is, yeah, she beat it and then tried to give it to Mariska, but because Mariska didn't fall for it.
Or didn't, like, touch it or whatever.
Yeah. It bounced back. And so now, yeah, like, Cherry Pop essentially strengthened it, failed to give it away, and got the stronger version thrown back at her.
Yeah.
Which is just cherrypop.txt. So yeah, I guess she has to beat it again and it's stronger, but then, oh man, that third time, like, that'll be good.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I assume Lucy has the power to undo it. That felt like something Lucy was very conscious of in 11.13. So you know, however much of Lucy's humanity survives this trial might be able to sort it out.
Mm. Yeah. So then another thing worth noting is Miss asks if Edith is secure, and the response is by Montague, which is just suspicious enough to be worth noting, just in case Montague turns out to be bad. I hope he's not.
No, I trust him. He was in that dream with Tashlet. He's our very respectable,
yeah,
whatever the fuck you meant to call him, guy. I mean, it's good. It's good news for Miss that he's there and not on the barrier, because that's like her big concern. Like, yes. We didn't really touch on, like, Rook actually has this moment with Miss where she's like, "Are you sure you want to get involved?" And Miss is like, "I have to." And Rook's like, "This is very brave and admirable, but also kind of dumb." And Miss is like, I have to. And I'm just like, fuck, I love you, Miss. And then also Rook, like, Rook, I love you, but Rook is the sort of person who will abandon you in a second if she needs to. I would not want Rook to have my back in an
important fight. She's not a dependable ally.
No, exactly. She, you know where she stands, and the problem is you're going to know when she no longer stands with you.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, Monty being with Edith raises an interesting point, which is, as the Aurum reminds us, Edith is bound in a prison set up by the Sable. Monty shouldn't have to augment that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just, like, I don't know. I'm just, like, Monty's whole thing about taking over systems is him taking over something the Sable made. That feels like it could be important. So I've sort of switched sides. Now I'm tinfoiling with you about whether that's suspicious.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
Because the Aurum gives us that great reminder where he sort of says, that barrier is put up by the Sable. If that's not good enough, then, like, who gives a shit? Because we clearly have nothing to do.
Mm.
Which feels like it could tie into this detail you've pulled out, which is Monty sitting on that barrier, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like it could be. We'll have to see, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you've gotten in my head with this one. I can see this being a thing now. I've done a complete 180 in the last 2 minutes.
There we go.
We also learned that Marisica is sending out messenger birds, because, of course, that's her thing, to her allies, which sounds like she's calling in, playing all her cards is the vibe I get, like that thing Toad Swallow said. Who could she be calling? Like, I mean, it's too late for the story to just introduce a whole new set of characters, right? Like, at least some of these are going to have to be people we know or heavily affiliated with people we know.
Possibly, right? People introduced from Marcy's interlude, but I can't think who that would be.
No, there weren't many. Well, I'm thinking, I reckon we're going to see some Blue Heron reunions or something. Like, I reckon, like, you know, maybe not Estrella, but...
But who... Why would they be aligned to Marcy?
Look, I don't know. Guillemay hires witch hunters in his spare time.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know what? That's fair enough. Maybe it's not. We've
established the fairy have their fingers in all these pies. Like, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it could be they could have reached out to witch hunters. She could have reached out to anyone. She doesn't have to be, you know, honest and say, hey, come and help me. She could just be pulling shenanigans.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. Miss was the one holding the witch hunters back, right?
Mm.
She's not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
How long have we got till they show up?
Yeah.
This is why I love Wild Birth stories. There are so many moving parts in this bullshit. I can't possibly predict what's going to happen in an arc.
What if it's Shelley? What if somehow Marcy and Shelley are aligned? Or worse, Daniel. That could actually be it.
I wouldn't be surprised if we get somebody from the Plex and somebody from the Blue Heron Institute as some of her allies, just especially because I'm hoping that more of the wider Blue Heron cast start to come to Kennet for the Kenneteer side, so that'll play nicely if both sides are calling people in.
Mm.
I mean, the other part of this that I can't remember where we talked about it. It might have just been on Discord, but like the whole thing with Guillemay hiring witch hunters and then the fact that witch hunters killed Estrella's whole family felt like this whole thing where it's kind of weird that the dude in the area who's about to turn into a winter fairy had is affiliated with the group that killed all the Winter Fairy practitioners.
Mm.
Like, it felt like he that might have been Guillemet just kind of making the terrain a bit easier for when he falls.
Mm.
Especially because he left all the kids alive and, you know, they might need a mentor. So as much as Estrella freaks me out, her being involved, if Marisica can tell Estrella that she thinks Guillemet is the one who got her family killed, then we can expect Estrella and friends to show up in force, right?
Yeah, that would be pretty rough if it's the case. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we can't possibly predict who it's going to be, but I do like the Estrella prediction. I think it's one of the strongest.
I can't wait to see who it is, and then I can't wait to see who the Kenneteers call into. Like, this is going to turn into such a large clusterfuck, and I'm very excited. As Rook says, it's war now, and I'm hyped.
Mm, yeah. So some of the other things that are hype here are the trio start to turn the tables. They they kind of clocked the fact that what they were going to offer to Marcy is the same as what they offered to Edith, which is a fair trial, and they basically should be entitled to that in this contest. So they earn the license to flip the stage, which who knows what the fuck that's going to mean, but it's an exciting lead-in for the next chapter.
Yeah, and this feels like a really good resolution to the idea I was pitching before of, like, if this is kind of secretly actually a test of their, like, moral code and their sense of justice, them being able to pull it by doing this, by saying, like, oh, we would have done these sorts of things, like, that feels like the way forward. And they don't quite get this one, but they get this great one where, like, yeah, they're going to get to flip the stage, and I'm kind of like, okay, the fuck does this look like?
Yeah.
Avery mentions trial by combat, but that can't possibly be their plan, given how fights against fairy have gone for all of them. I wonder how real are these other fairy in this thing? I'm very confused by members of this stage.
They have to have pretty low years of experience, right?
Yeah.
So by that they have to basically be not real at all, right? Because, like, I don't know how they could be actual fairy and not be any more than, like, a year old.
Yeah, like, I'm just thinking that feels like the way to flip it to me is, like, we keep hearing about how fairy are never really friends. They're always keeping plans to stab each other in the back. The fact that Finne has brought in 80 other fae slash fae-fae, is that the trick? If they can turn the rest of them against her, I don't know if that quite counts as flipping in this sense of, like, trial by combat. I don't know what this... Can they just change which court it is, maybe? Use some of their own glamour to fucking switch to a different court?
Mm.
Pull in Summer Court and have, like, Guillemet ride in on a gallant steed.
Yeah, maybe.
Whatever the fuck. Yeah, I don't know. I'm extremely hyped for this. I don't quite know what shape it's going to take, but it's a very fun idea.
Yeah, again, I'm racking my brain trying to think of, like, what could it reasonably be? And it's just impossible to predict this very stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. Especially, like, as we saw in this whole trial, these rules are bullshit. Like you can't predict them. Once you sort of... And I think, like, one of the best things about this universe is the way that, like, quite a few sort of twists or something will be rules that kind of make sense in retrospect but do kind of seem like they were impossible to predict beforehand. And I feel like that's sort of what we're heading for with this flip thing, where once you read it, you'll be like, oh, obviously that is what you would do, but it's just not the sort of thing a reasonable person will expect beforehand.
Yeah. I'm excited to see what it's going to end up being.
Yeah.
But they'll have to wait for next time, because that's the end of the chapters for today. Before we go, though, let's dive into some pale predictions, you know. We had Ace of Sword make a great prediction last time that came true, and let's see if any of our predictions this time come true. Elliot, do you want to start with yours?
Sure. So I pulled out a prediction from Propaganda Pagoda, who basically says, so paths draw on, they've said the runners. I think they mean finders. Runners is from Stargate Atlantis, or probably something else. I doubt this is a Stargate Atlantis reference. but yeah, basically saying, like, the trains and the promenade seem to bring in acquaintances. So like the fact that, you know, people like the ballerina and the wolf showed up, maybe it's not just random others that get brought in or random lost that get brought in, but it's specifically like ones with connections to the contestants, which I like. It would explain why the wolf would come when there's so many of them, because she's like the common thread, with the Forest Ribbon Trail being Finder 101. But basically, so Propaganda Pagoda goes on to sort of say, yeah, so you, there's sort of these unknown knowns where it's going to be somebody you know who comes in on a train, but you don't know exactly who. Like that, so that's their guess at what how the trains actually work on here. And so what Propaganda thinks is maybe your reward at the end of the trail is you get a train that takes you to somewhere you like need to go or have been before, but maybe can't get back to.
Mm.
So it's kind of, you know, but again, you don't really get to choose. So it's just like the train will take you somewhere in your past that maybe you need to go, but it's an unknown known, you know, like just this idea that like the train connects you to the rest of the paths and to like places you've walked in the past is a fun idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. I really like the idea of this reward. I think it's a cool, it would fit with the promenade, right? I think it's awesome.
Yeah, the idea that you get to take the train somewhere else. Like the promenade has just felt like this kind of central hub of all the paths, like in so many ways. So the idea that the reward is just, it connects you to other parts makes sense.
Yeah.
Propaganda Pagoda actually predicts that Avery will use it to find Jess Kasabian's like cousin's Echo.
Yeah.
Which like I kind of get the vibe that Jess is pretty close to finding that by herself. So,
yes, I got that vibe too.
I don't know if about that, but yeah, I like this idea of, yeah, like Avery will sort of get on one of these trains and get somewhere that will just have a bit of a like, oh, this is exactly what we need to get someone on side or to do this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So I brought a prediction from Snowdrop's Tiny Fan. And the prediction they submitted here is basically the short version of a Reddit post they put up on the subreddit today, which I read and was wonderful. To summarize very briefly, Charles was originally the mastermind, but the original plan was kind of different and more kind of improvised or reactionary to what we're seeing since the Kenneteers have entered the story and Mariska kind of took over. I like this one because, you know, we obviously dive in pretty detail-oriented on each chapter, so we don't usually zoom back out that much. Hmm. But this is a great prediction and a great thread to start prompting thoughts around, okay, who's the mastermind and why is, what are they actually, what's the motive for killing the Carmine Beast, basically?
Yeah, and like Snowdrop's Tiny Fan is the person who's got their fucking 4 billion page Google Doc on the conspiracy, which has just actually become a resource I check every now and then to like fact check something I half remember, because if it's at all relevant to the overall conspiracy, it's in there with Snowdrop's Tiny Fan's like objective thoughts about how it relates to other things, as well as the subjective ones. Clearly, like Snowdrop's Tiny Fan has quickly become like the encyclopedia of Pale in a really fun way.
Mm. Yeah, it's yeah. They're doing great. The stuff they've put together is wonderful, and this document is especially wonderful.
Yeah, like this is all the stuff I'm just A, bad at, and B, would never have the time to do.
Yeah,
and this document is such a resource.
Yeah. So yeah, great stuff. Great predictions. If you have predictions, you can leave them in our discussion thread, which you can find in the show notes down below.
Well, no, sorry, actually, you should submit them through Power Predictor.
Oh, sorry.
Which is also linked in the show notes.
Yeah.
The discussion thread would probably be the best place for you to answer our discussion question.
I got my things mixed up.
No, yeah, I figured they're right next to each other here in the dock. So we're halfway through this fortnight's discussion question, which is, if you were subverting yourself to fight a fairy, what practice would you lean into?
Yeah.
What animal would your mask be?
I think this is such a great discussion question, and I'm excited to see more responses to it.
Yep, we did. Although I do just want to say, we got I think one or two answers where people said, this is the practice I do, and then here's the exact opposite. And I don't feel like that's the vibe with this subverting yourself to fight the fairy. I think it's more interesting to say, what is the path you chose not to take for whatever reason?
Yeah. If anything, what's the part of your... it feels like to me, what's the part of your personality you've intentionally acknowledged and are trying to move away from?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what's something about yourself that you have decided you don't want to foster?
Yeah. And then what would the practice version of that be, you know?
Yeah. So not that those other answers are irrelevant, but like I just would encourage people to think of these more interesting ideas, because it's a more fun nuance, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah. So yeah, leave your answer to that in the discussion thread, linked in the show notes down below. If you want to get more of us, you can always check out our Twitter, which is at PowerReflectCast, or just search PowerReflections on Twitter. There'll be live reads on there. They're coming back, Elliot.
Yes, they will be starting up, I think it's the day after this episode comes out. They took a quick kind of unexpected hiatus for, you know, 3 weeks, but I'm going to try and do them again, because the last 3 weeks I've also ended up reading both chapters a few hours before we record, and I want to stop doing that because it's awful. So, yeah, you know, you can check that. That's also where we post news. Like, this episode is coming out 2 days later than it normally did, and one day after another episode. And if you want shit like that to be less of a surprise, follow us on Twitter.
Yeah. And of course, head to doofmedia.com for all the other news on all the other shows on the Doof Media Network, and for things like the news on this Pale Conflections fan art contest about siblings, to give all the details. Theme is siblings. You have until Friday, July 30th at midnight Pacific Standard Time to submit your responses. There's a cash prize, $100 for first place.
Yep.
$25 for second place. Yeah. Plus, lots of great fan art. Their patrons will all be voting on it. So if you want to vote on the fan art, become a patron. There's probably other details as well, but that's the big ones, I think.
Yeah. All the nitty gritty details are in the doc that I'll make sure I put in the show notes for this one. But yeah, $100 prize, end of July. That's basically the TLDR. It is also only Otherverse things, so it can be Pale. It can also be Pact. Please sort of, I mean, Ruben and I should be able to tell which it belongs to. I'd be embarrassed if we couldn't, but include it in the email submission anyway. Yeah. Yeah, but not. No parahumans for this one, just because, you know, the Otherverse is in full swing on Doof at the moment, so we decided to lean in. Also, siblings, we just don't need the siblings art that's going to come out of including parahumans.
Especially Ward, yeah. yeah.
So, yeah, and anything Otherverse is fair game as well. Like Pack Dice, Poke, whatever, this is that whole universe.
I'm just going to say this now to ensure we don't get the obvious piece of worm fan art. A picture that you submit just of Gru standing by himself.
Doesn't count.
The joke, we all thought of the joke. Okay, you don't need to make it. We all know what it would have been. Stick to Pact and Pale Fanner.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. Oh, God. I don't know. Yeah, did you see? Hopefully as well, we will probably be finished, but this, you know, Malia and Jenny will hopefully be doing the costume contest come October, because I'm still so mad at us for forgetting to do that last year.
Yeah, no, me too. The costumes were some of my favorite fan art submissions when we did that, and it was a real bummer that we missed it.
They were all parahumans, and then last year we had the opportunity to do a Pale Pact themed costume competition, and we forgot, and I hated myself for remembering on like November 3rd that it was an option we had. So I'm so glad that even though we might be gone come that time this year, Malia and Jenny are going to be here to pick up the slack. Anyway, so that's just in a little aside I brought up to just mention how much I hate us for forgetting to do that last year.
I feel like a lot of Otherverse costumes are going to require some form of colored contacts. So start prepping for that now, folks, whether it's blacked out contacts for Matthew, glowing eyes for Edith, you know, colored ones if you're a Kenneteer using their site. Whatever it is, make sure you get your colored contacts in early.
Yeah. So yeah, but for now, also just think about the fan art contest.
Yeah.
That's advice I'm giving to us as well as to you.
Don't plan out too far in front. Just focus on the current one. If you want to support all the things we do at Doof Media, including things like being able to have prizes for these contests, You can support those things by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/duffmedia and become a patron. You get all kinds of cool perks, including the best perk of that warm feeling of knowing that you helped us keep doing these cool things that we try.
Yeah, also, as Ruben mentioned, it's the patrons who vote who wins the fan art contest. There's also another contest we mentioned last week, Do the King Thing, that Scott and Matt are running on Kingslingers, so yeah. You get to vote in that too. Get early access to all that cool Stephen King fanfic stuff. Well, it's not fanfic, it's like Stephen King-ish premises that are your own thing. But yeah, so I'm quite keen to see how those turn out. So yeah, head to Patreon if you want to support us.
Yeah. While you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wabo's Patreon as well and support him for doing all the cool things he does, like finally giving us this Cherry Pop interlude that we all have wanted. That's at patreon.com/Wabo.
Yeah, if people didn't support Wabo on Patreon, this just wouldn't exist. That's crazy.
Yeah. So
don't let that be reality.
Make sure you support him, I suppose.
Cool. Well, we'll see you all next week for presumably more false moves. I mean, that'd be a wild twist if it just ends now.
Yeah, we'll see.